Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, Dan Bays is our guest. Dan's been in commercial recording studio work, jingles and that kind of thing, commercials. And he's written some incredible software that broadcasters, many broadcasters, use every day. Dan Bays on routing, orchestration, and automation. Coming up next on TWRT. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, savings, and support, online at bgs.cc. By Broadcast Bionics, with the Bionic Studio, including talk show control, social media, and visual radio, Broadcast Bionics brings exceptional audience engagement to radio and TV. By Angry Audio, audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. And by Max Connect Wireless, prioritized high-speed internet service designed for transmitter sites and remote broadcasts. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about everything from the microphone to that light bulb there that came off the top of the tower. I'm Kirk Harnack, today coming to you as usual from the Nashville studio of This Week in Radio Tech. It's our Nashville outpost. It's the Telus Alliance studio, I should say. Telus Alliance sponsors my studio, takes care of some of the gear here. And today, Telus Alliance even supplied my guest. Isn't that great? And so my guest today is Dan Bays. Dan, welcome into the show. It's so good to see you.
Thanks, Kirk.
But most people don't know who Dan Bays is. There are a select few. There's a few hundred people on the planet who know exactly who Dan Bays is. But instead of me saying, Dan, why don't you tell us who you are? Give us the elevator speech on Dan Bays.
Oh, well, the elevator speech on how I got into where I'm at. So I spent close to 25 or 27 years working at a recording studio. Originally started out as a post-production engineer for them. In the course of the work there, I started writing a number of tools that helped our workflows work better. And so that kind of spawned into a second business, a second company, which at the time was called Software Authority. And so that's kind of where that all went to. And I've been doing work in one form or another with Telus for many years now, going back all the way into the mid-90s when the recording studio I was working for actually landed a radio show. And so we needed a call screening program, and I started writing a call screening program, and Steve Church heard about it and asked us to partner. And next thing you know, that became the very first assistant producer way back in the day. So
I really realized that you were the first author of assistant producer.
Yeah. Way back in the day. This particular radio show was a show called Biker Broadcasting, ran from 10 to midnight on Sunday nights, and went up over a Zephyr to ABC and then over their satellite to syndicated stations all over the place. And we needed a way to screen the calls. And so, at the time I'd had no broadcast experience. I was strictly, recording studio experience. And I kind of came up with a concept and started going on it, not really knowing there was such a thing as a call screener. So kind of where that all came from.
So folks, Dan Bays is our guest. Dan and I have known each other for probably getting close to 20 years. And we're going to talk about an area of software monitoring and control of broadcast facilities that you might refer to as orchestration, or you might refer to as automation. And they're a little bit two different things. Dan's going to help us understand what one is, what the other is, and maybe explain to us why each has come into its own in the last few years. COVID has probably sped things up, but broadcast facilities, from small ones to very, very large ones, are insisting on having some kind of orchestration software. So we're going to get into that. Hey, I want to mention that our show is also brought to you in part by Ray Topp over at Radio Guide. And you can find a Radio Guide on the web at radio-guide.com. Radio-guide.com. You'll find great feature-length articles. I do mean feature-length, long articles. If you want to delve into the tech, this is a great place to do it. Of course, you'll find ads from some of my favorite places like Telus Alliance. There's an ad for Quasar, really cool AOIP console there. And so anyway, check it out, radio-guide.com, and you can sign up for the print version and have it sent to your home, like I do, if you like. Thanks a lot, Ray Topp, radio-guide.com. All right, Dan, so you started in commercial recording. Does that mean you were originally an audio guy and not so much a software development guy?
Yeah. That's actually kind of where I started, was in, it was in audio. I mean, I originally started, got hired to come in the evenings part-time to pull lifts, sound bites basically for the next day's commercials. Cause at that time we did a lot of business, for sweeps. We did a lot of radio commercials for TV stations, for sweeps work. And so I would come in the evenings and find all of the movie quotes for the, you know, the movies that they wanted to run to try to draw people in. And I'd splice them up with leader tape so that they'd be ready for the next day's commercials. So that was kind of one of my first jobs when I started at the studio, and went from there into.
These were very topical commercials then. These are commercials that TV stations ran on radio stations to get you to watch the TV stations during sweeps, because it was worth money to the TV station. Yes. To have even a tenth of a higher share in the market. Because they could bump their advertising rates up.
Yep. Wow. Yeah. No. The number of times that I've pulled the soundbite from Predator, from Arnold Schwarzenegger saying "Kill me, I'm here, kill me," you know, and splice that in for whatever they're going to run that particular movie. So I did a lot of that, and then we also did a lot of the news promos. You know, what you hear could change your life kind of things. So yeah, that was a lot of that's where we started. But you know, the business at commercial morphed over the years to do a lot of different things. We also did a lot of jewelry advertising, so Kay, Jared, all those kinds of things. So there was that was our bread and butter business was all advertising, and not so much bands and music, though we did do a little bit of that as well. So
were you ever talent yourself? Did you ever sing "Every Kiss Begins with K"?
No. Well, I was a lot of times when we would do sound effects, you know, we do crowd sound effects and stuff like that. They'd pull everybody in the building in to do those kinds of things. So I did some of those kinds of sound effects. But yeah, no, I was never a voice talent. Now my son was a voice talent for, a spot when he was really young. I think it was, it may have been Smith Dairy, actually, that he did something for at one point in time. So that was kind of fun.
Well, I ask all these questions about your recording career, because that obviously plays into your understanding of what broadcasters need. If you need it in a recording studio, there's a good chance you need some modified version of that in a broadcast facility. And I understand one of your earliest, maybe not your earliest, but one of the substantial things that you did was you wrote some software to handle route changes at the recording studio. Tell me about how you got started into writing software. Out of necessity, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, that kind of thing?
Yeah, a lot of it just came down to, I mean, as far as getting into writing software, I mean, I had written back in the 80s, my brother got really interested in computers and so ended up buying a Commodore PET. You can look a picture of that up on the internet sometimes. It's 8K of RAM and backed up to a cassette tape drive. And my dad taught me how to, you know, draw a little spaceship that fired on it, and I got hooked. And so through late grade school, I wrote a lot of half-finished arcade games. And so that's where I got into it. But then I pretty much got out of it in high school and college. And it was not until I came back to the recording studio and started realizing, you know, at that point we just put our first digital system in. We still had four rooms that were analog, and we had one room that was running a Lexicon Opus digital audio workstation. And started realizing, you know, we didn't even really know how to pull up a directory on some of these. And so I started digging back into it, and it's like, okay, I remember this stuff. And we started writing tools to help out how we did things. We actually built a real-time audio network. It was just file sharing. I mean, basically putting all of our files onto a central server and playing them real-time, which, you know, these days that's, you know, even think about that kind of thing. But at that time it was mid 90s, and, you know, switch technology was not even something that was readily available at a reasonable price. So we were trying to do this with hubs and split, you know, have multiple NICs in the server and split the hubs up so we didn't have too many collisions. And, but once we got all that working and started dealing with, you know, those audio players for doing, you know, the piggybacks and all that kind of stuff, we pretty much revolutionized the way we did business. We built a sound effects library, was all running off of that. And that was an interesting business thing, actually, that we discovered. When I started there, all of the sound effects were CDs. And so you had a book and you would look up what sound effect you want for the spot. And then you'd have to go pull the CDs. And so we ended up putting all of that on a server and making it available, you know, with a quick search program. Now, Kirk, what is a recording studio sell?
What do they sell? I always thought recording studios sold time for you to come in and record what you want. Exactly. But I could be wrong. Oh, okay.
Exactly. They sell time. Now, if you make things more efficient, theoretically, you're reducing. In reality, we found that wasn't true, because what would happen is every time we would be going out to get CDs, the clients would start watching their wrist watch. They'd be watching the clock. It's like, how long is this taking? But if it was right there at their fingertips, they would sit there and play all day long, you know, and just,
gotcha.
So by making it more efficient, they actually, and so that was an interesting thing we discovered about business through doing some of this kind of stuff. So,
wow. That sounds like me getting lost.
A lot of things.
It sounds like me getting lost in Wikipedia and reading about things I never knew I had an interest in, but it's right there. So they have all these sound effects. Hey, what about this one? Ooh, here's a better flyover. Oh, listen, this crowd is this. Hey, there's a lady screaming in this one. Isn't that better than the man screaming? Yeah. Spent all kinds of time with that. Well, all billable time too. But what we're moving to in this interview, folks, is talking about orchestration and automation software, and we'll get to that. But I wanted to establish Dan's roots in this, and so Dan, maybe you could take us into this area of routing, which is what informed you as to start writing something called Pathfinder later on. What did you have to do with routing in the recording studio?
So one of the issues that we ran into, and this was again back in the 90s, so we needed to be able to route audio, video, and at that time it was Sony 9-pin machine control. You know what that is?
No.
So basically it's an RS-422 serial command set that would allow you to push the transports of Sony video decks around. So, and then lock them with time code and that kind of thing. And so we would have racks of these video decks in a centralized room, and we had multiple studios that needed to share those, which of course is exactly what you do with routers. So, and there are a number of companies that made routers that would do all of those at the same time. It would do audio, it would do video, it would do machine control, but we found that they were really expensive. And we kind of started looking and said, well, I can pick up an AES router from this company, and I can pick up a serial port router from this company, and I could pick up a little, and altogether they were quite a bit less expensive, but we had to marry those together and make them so that you're not doing a whole bunch of changes just to get one thing done. And so that's really where I started writing the software for these. I started looking at the various control protocols for each of these different manufacturers' products and, building up the route lists from each of the routers, and then being able to build what we'll later talk about as a virtual router on top of that, that marries those layers together in the same way that you would if you would had bought that as one system. And so that's really where I got into it. And it was originally something called Patch Bay Control, and we used it for many, many years at the studio there for routing all of our stuff all over the building. And that was sort of the roots.
So at some point, what you're going to get into, along came a technology, audio over IP, which worked without a central matrix. So there wasn't a central box to control the routing of audio or GPIO data. Instead, the routing was actually done by a method of publish, if you will, publish and subscribe. So, you know, sources of audio, whether it's, you know, Victrola 1, Victrola 2, or ABC Radio Network, or, you know, automation playout numbers 1 through 5, those are all published on the network. And then things that receive those things or could receive those things, you know, need to be able to select, hey, what am I going to put out my output here that goes to the transmitter or to the speakers or to the headphones? And so we're going to get into kind of how that works and how your knowledge of routing control played into that. And then I want to also hear about how you came to decide that, hey, I have the ability to get different brands of equipment to talk to each other, either because I understand the protocol and I wrote about it, or I have a translator. I can receive a command from here. I know that means do this, and I'll tell this other system to do this in a either a more generic form or it's in its format. So that's all coming up. I want to preface with that. And we're also going to hear, like he promising, about, you know, what is orchestration software and why is it important to broadcast facilities nowadays? Hey, it's Kirk Harnack in the Telos Alliance studio in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm talking to Dan Bays. Dan is the project manager for the Pathfinder project at Telos Alliance. Hey, our show is brought to you in part by our friends at Broadcasters General Store and the Broadcast Tools ProMix 4. It's a compact, full-featured, get this is going to sound weird, it's a mono audio mixing console. Why would you have a mono console? Because there's plenty of times when a mono console is just fine. I'll give you an example. If you're going to speak the words, "he shoots, he scores," through the console, a mono console is probably just fine. So it's perfect for almost any broadcast studio where you're just doing like voice tracks. It features three combination mic line inputs and a dedicated fourth input that can be switched between a balanced line input or the built-in USB audio interface. It has three stereo headphone outputs, and guess what? They're quarter-inch size headphone outputs. So, you know, you don't have to dink around with these little tiny, you know, 3.5 millimeter headphones. These are the full-size ones. They're included. And they have controls for volume, mix, and pan, allowing custom headphone mixes. It's got some other features like a switch selectable program limiter. So when that talent yells out, "he shoots, he scores," it can be properly limited and not blow the output. It has an XLR program output to feed something professional. It has a monitor output with muting and volume control. It has a mix minus output for connection to an external telephone hybrid. And it even has an on-air light relay output. You won't find that on the cheap home consoles. You'll find that, though, on the ProMix 4. It's a great choice for remote broadcasting and podcasting, too. You know where you get this ProMix 4? And by the way, there's a whole bunch of accessories to go along with it for headphone monitoring and mic muting and that kind of thing. You need to check out the whole line of these products in the ProMix series. Get them from Broadcasters General Store. Now, you can visit their website is at bgs.cc, but you know what I like to do? Because these people are so good on the phone. I mean, they're so knowledgeable and helpful. Call them at 352-622-7700. And, you know, with all the companies nowadays that don't want to talk to you on the phone, Broadcaster General Store is different. They do want to talk to you on the phone. What a great break from your day in typing and going to the web all the time. You can do that. You can go to the web, bgs.cc, but you can also give them a call. And you're going to have a friendly voice on the other end that actually knows what they're talking about. And they're going to help guide you to the right decision, the right product for what you need. They'll get you a delivery time. They'll get you an excellent price. They got sharp pencils there at bgs.cc. Broadcasters General Store, home of all of the broadcast tools products from Don Wingate, including the ProMix 4. Thanks a lot, BGS, for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. All right. Hey, we're with Dan Bays. Dan writes this software that is absolutely invaluable to so many broadcasters for what it can do. Dan, why don't you start us off with the story of how you came to be involved with audio over IP?
So that was actually the Telos actually approached me because they had heard that I'd written this software for controlling multiple routers for our studio, based on earlier relationships that we'd had with things like the assistant producer and another program I wrote called Zephyr Remote. And so they contacted me and said, "Hey, you know, look, we've got all of these devices that we're creating that are going to be on this network. And we know that people aren't going to want to log into every single one of these different web pages to make, you know, a route change here and then log into that one to make a route change there. We need to be able to bring all of this together and display it as a single router." And since they know I had a program that I was working on to do that kind of thing, they asked for me to start working with them and partnering with them on that. And so that is where we changed the name and we started, you know, adding all of that kind of functionality to it. And kind of was the birth of the of Pathfinder. And then it grew into the monster that it is today.
So when, as we mentioned a few minutes ago, an audio over IP system, and you, of course, the first one out there really for broadcast was Axia's LiveWire network. And there are others out there now. And then the kind of, in a way, they've kind of come together with AES 67 on a protocol everyone can agree on. But so when you have a centralized router, I guess, and I'm not real familiar with centralized routers from SAS or Leech or anybody else. I never really used these myself. I never worked at a radio station big enough that that had a central router of any size. We did have some broadcast tools, you know, switchers, but not a real actual router. But those routers typically, did they typically have some control software that lets you look at the routes and make route changes? Did that come kind of standard with them?
A lot of them did. Most of them did have something like that. And that was even, you know, even the ones, because that's what we were essentially setting up and creating at the studio with these various disparate manufacturers. So our main audio router was at that time a Z-System C Tangler, which was, I think we started out with a 32x32. And by the time we were done, we were up to 256x256 AES router. But again, one of the things that I loved so much when we got into audio over IP was, you know, in those days, if you maxed out your 64x64 router, you threw it away and bought a bigger one. I mean, it wasn't a matter, you know, I mean, sometimes you might have a card cage where you can add additional cards, but eventually you run up out of space on that. Whereas with audio over IP, you know, I mean, you just keep adding additional devices to it and you get more capacity. So I really liked the way that grew. And eventually at the very end, we did end up, you know, I mean, we didn't end up switching to audio over IP for our studio initially, but that's largely because we already had the infrastructure set up and it was working. But eventually we did actually switch to that because it was simpler, you know, and at that time, our AES router had finally died after years and years. So,
If folks don't know, you know, indeed with a centralized router, you're limited to the matrix size of that router. And you mentioned 32x32 or 64x64 or 256x256. These are common sizes. There's even huge routers that may be 1024x1024, and they're really expensive. But when you get into audio over IP, you're now limited by something different. You're limited by, typically, since it's multicast, you're limited by the number of IGMP groups that a given core switch, Ethernet switch, can keep track of. And so these come in different sizes, but, you know, 10,000 is a typical, pretty large maximum for Ethernet switches to keep track of IGMP groups. Maybe you know of a bigger one, but that's been a pretty big solid maximum. Although maybe there's bigger ones now, because with AES 67 and the multicast IP address range, I think you can have close to something like, I want to say, 14 million possible sources on a network. You have that many multicast IP addresses?
You may know more on that than I do. I'm actually not sure on that one, but I guess there is still some correlation in that, you know, you could run out and have to replace the switch, but you know, all of those audio spigots are still, you know, you don't have to replace all of that.
But and that's not a physical limitation of how many cross points can I create. That's a simply, you know, the switch designer said, we're going to set aside this much memory for this many IGMP groups. And so on a small switch, it's less. On a big switch, it's more. Point is, though, when you have a distributed network and more, if you're doing audio over IP or video over IP, you're dealing with a distributed network. I've got some intercom systems here right behind me that are distributed intelligence. These intercom panels are not dumb panels. They're very smart panels, but there's no central matrix for these in the infinity line. Therefore, they need to keep track of what's going on the network, and they do. So point there being, when a network is distributed, you really need some software to begin to keep track of or control or monitor what's going on across the whole network. And I guess that was your motivation to take what you'd already done and expand it to take care of what could potentially be a pretty big network with a lot of end pieces. Yeah. Does that describe how you really kind of fell into or you know, developed Pathfinder?
Yeah. That was really where it came from. You know, we'd already done some of this work with other manufacturers, but this was a totally different ballgame because, you know, you're not talking to one centralized piece. You're reaching out to a whole bunch of different, and monitoring the states of all of those different pieces of equipment all the time, constantly, and, you know, keeping those up to date and then allowing you to make changes in all of those. So that's,
Hey,
Why don't we start looking at some of the pictures that you provide, some of the graphics, and this will help explain, you know, where we're going with this. Suncast, if you want to pop the first graphic up, and Dan, you can tell us about what we're looking at here in order. So this is router details, AXI audio. What are we looking at here?
So this is just the audio router. So an AXI audio router. This is one view of it. We've got a couple of different ways that you can look at this router. So this is sort of like a list view. You've got a filter up on the right hand side where you can look at an individual source or destination. So you're seeing your source on the one side and you're seeing your destination on the right hand side. And so you can see what's routed. And then we can click on any one of those and pop up a source selector.
So this is tabular. So, yeah, we're seeing all the sources on the left and descriptions and then the destination where they route to. And really, when you make a change in a route, you're not making a change of something in the middle per se. You're really telling the destination device, hey, subscribe to this other thing that I want you to now.
Right. And you're really just doing a control. So you're telling this destination device, pick up a different stream. And then, you know, the audio is not actually flowing through this program at all. This program is just sending commands as to pick up, you know, to say what to pick up, you know, whenever you make a route change. As we start eventually talking about orchestration, we can talk a little bit how this actually sort of mirrors some of the orchestration kinds of concepts. This is one view. If you look at the second picture, it'll show a different view actually. That is it's really the same router that we were just looking at on the second view, but in a different layout basically.
Suncast, let's see that second picture if you bring that up. So this is graphically showing what you were showing in a tabular form before.
Yeah. And I've got customers that like both. A lot of people like this graphical view. I actually tend to prefer the tabular view because for me, it's just easier to see what's going on across the router, but to each their own. So it's interesting. You know, we can keep going through some of these pictures and we can talk a little bit more about this. It might be interesting though to switch gears for a minute and talk orchestration and then come back to this for a minute.
Yeah. Okay. Let's look at you and me then and tell me about orchestration.
So the reason I was thinking that might be an interesting idea since that's kind of the topic of what we're talking about here is orchestration is an interesting subject for me. So let's start with sort of a thought experiment about orchestration. We'll actually talk about an orchestra. So if we're thinking about an orchestra, and we think each of these players is basically like a task. And so the orchestration is taking all of those tasks and turning them into the symphony. Simple, fairly simple analogy. It works for, you know, the computing parallels fairly easily. Where this gets interesting is that, to me anyway, you can zoom in and zoom out of these things. So if I think about an individual player, so let's say we think about the first violin player, they're doing all of these finger movements. They've got 10 fingers, they've got their bow, and they're doing all of these things to make that one stream of music that is a part of that orchestra. So in reality, they're orchestrating all of that, each of those individual movements. And so we can think about that player as orchestrating all those movements, and then you wrap that up and it becomes another task to the full orchestration. We could take another step back from that and start thinking about the administrative task staff who is actually orchestrating an entire season. Each of one of these is where each concert is a task. And so what I'm trying to get to here is the difference between between a task and an orchestration is an orchestration is a bunch of tasks being put together to reach a common goal. But in reality, that orchestration can be a task in a higher up orchestration. It starts working in layers. And so if we've been at this point, you know, I don't know how many of you are thinking about that scene in Animal House where they're sitting around smoking pot and thinking about the grain of sand on your fingernail that could be a universe and that kind of thing, but it's a little bit like that. Where this gets interesting is now when we start talking about IT when we start thinking about things in layers, we can we start thinking about how those layers are important for things like scale, the ability to scale things up and down, and the ability to do redundancy and all of those kinds of things. And so that's one of those concepts that I'm anyway. I'll let. Sorry, Kirk, I can't.
So how does orchestration look in, let's say that, you know, the people asking about or talking about orchestration first tend to be these very large broadcast organizations. I don't know if they did or not, but a name like Swedish Radio or, the large broadcasters in Germany or in Britain, you know, state size broadcasters or India, you know, All India Radio, for example. How are these people wanting to put orchestration to use?
So again, if we take that analogy that I was just talking about and move that out to something like IT, because there's a lot of overlap and parallels between IT and what we are now doing, especially as more and more things go towards the internet. Mm-hmm. So there's a variety of different tools out there that we can use for what we're going to call orchestration. And those could be, anything from things like Ansible or within Docker, things like Kubernetes. And so a lot of these kinds of tools are all about taking a set of tasks and being able to scale them up and down as dynamically as you want. So if we think about in the IT world, something like a website, that website might just be a single web server that we spin up that spins up, you know, a single site that has maybe 10 or 20 users or something like that. Or, you know, it might be that if you're thinking of something like Amazon, you know, at that point now you're talking about a database, you're talking about each of these different layers. And the issue there becomes when you're trying to scale up and down, you have to decide where those bottlenecks are and what you can actually increase or decrease to meet those scales. So, for example, the number of sales that Amazon made today is nowhere near what they would be making on like a Black Friday or a Cyber Monday. And so the ability to have your tools be able to sense when capacity is growing or shrinking is really where you start getting into what these orchestration tools can do. You set up a specific set of tasks and you say, okay, so going back to that website again, if that website was just going to host for 10 people and it's a static website, then our tool might just be a web server and that's it. If it was, if it's something more like what Amazon's doing now, we've got a database, we've got a set in the middle that's actually doing the processing of the data, the database to actually present something on the screen. And each of those layers may be a bottleneck that needs to be scaled up to more instances or less instances. And so that's really where we start looking at orchestration, one side of orchestration. The other side of orchestration is monitoring all of that equipment. And so the reason I started talking about the layers in the beginning is that website analogy I just used will use one set of tools to orchestrate their tools. On the other hand, a hosting provider is going to use a completely different set of tools because they really just want to see, you know, is the site up or down? What's the status of my, you know, the tools that I'm actually giving for them to create a site? And so it depends on what level of layer of the orchestration you're talking about as to which tools you're going to use. Going back to the orchestra analogy, I mean, you could say the conductor's baton is an orchestration tool. It could also be a stick that you throw to your dog to fetch. You know, it's how you use the tools that define whether it's an orchestration tool or not. So going back to your example in broadcasting, so let's come back out of the IT and back into broadcasting. The reason I kind of touched on this before we get into the next section of Pathfinder is that we're gonna start talking about some of these layers. But there's a number of things that these large organizations want, and it's kind of a blend between IT and what we're doing in things like Pathfinder. So there's there's control orchestration where you're orchestrating the control of the broadcast equipment. But then there's also sort of the IT where you want a tool that's going to monitor the health, you know, the power supply voltages, you know, all those kinds of things. And there's a blend there because Pathfinder can do a lot of that too. And so you can build up, you know, a screenshot that's going to show all of that information. But there's also a lot of open source tools out there that do that kind of thing already, things like Nagios or Splunk or, you know, a number of those tools. And so, you know, there's always this blending of what layer you're actually trying to orchestrate and what the right tool is for that layer. And
gotcha.
Hopefully okay. I made some sort of sense in all of
well,
that.
Well, and I'm guessing something, a protocol like SNMP can fall into this whole yes. multi-tiered thing as well. Okay.
Yes,
okay.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. SNMP right. is a fairly standard one.
I'll tell you what, are you ready to go back and look at a couple pictures before we take our
sure.
next break? I kind of want to wet our whistle for what's coming up. So you want to look at picture number three at this point?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. All right. Let's look at number three. Is that number two right there?
Yeah, this is number two. So we'll
okay. Yeah. So let's move on. There we go. What's this now?
All right. Okay. So, one of the things you can do in Pathfinder, so these last two routers that we were just looking at, well, the last router, we were seeing two different views of the router. So that router mm-hmm. was just an audio router. We're looking at all of the audio sources and destinations on our network. Now, if you wanted to let the office manager be able to switch and change which audio feeds were playing on the speakers in the lobby, you're right. not going to want to give that person access to that whole router because that whole router right. actually affects what's going to air. And so you want to create a cut down. You want to create a router that just has the sources and destinations that your individual users need to use. And so that's one thing that you can do with a virtual router. And so again, here, what we're kind of doing is if you think about that main audio router is orchestrating the route changes across all of these network devices. Now we're stepping back another layer and we're saying, okay, we're going to create a virtual router that just has the pieces part from the main router that we want. Now, so that's one aspect of how you can use a virtual router. The other aspect of it is going back to this idea that we talked about early on, where we were trying to get the audio and the machine control and the video all routing at the same time. In this example, you'll notice that what I'm creating in this is a single source in a virtual router, but that source has three layers under the hood. It's got an audio router, it's got a GPIO router source, and it's got a SAP property source. We'll come back to the SAP property source in a minute, but we've created three layers in that single source. And so in the destination on that virtual router, we'd create those same three layers. And now when we're making routes, if you want, you can kind of jump to the next picture for a minute. When we're making routes, this is all the user sees. And the user will route one source to a destination. And they may not even know that under the hood, we just made three routes to six different devices, using six different devices to make the change. So we've stepped back another layer in this. And this becomes really useful for things like automation systems, where you may be routing, the audio to and from the automation system. You are going to be routing GPIO triggers to and from the automation system. And you may be routing metadata. So that SAP property router that I skipped past, this is something that's fairly new in Pathfinder, but we've added the ability so that any property that Pathfinder knows about can become a source or destination in the router. So for example, we could have just an open TCP socket that is, you know, seeing maybe from a satellite is seeing the break duration information come in. And we could be using that as a layer in this router so that we're actually routing the break duration information to the automation system so that the automation system can then, you know, build the spot block to match whatever the break's going to be in advance. So there's those kinds of things that we can start to do once anything can be a route. I mean, technically, one of the things that we could do is you could actually use a SAP property router to dynamically change which mix engine, you know, a Quasar mix engine, a fader bank was routed to, and dynamically change that depending on you know, if you needed to do that.
So, wow. Okay. Okay.
So that automates all of that, but it also makes it's good for redundancy as well, so that we can take, you know, all of these signals and route them to two different redundant systems and that kind of thing.
And we haven't yet looked at what the user would see. You said if, you know, it could be the secretary at the front desk changing the lobby speaker routing. That person probably wouldn't even see this panel, right? They'd have some kind of easy button panel with some buttons on it, right?
Yep. So we'll step back some more layers and see that kind of user interface here shortly. Though some people do, I mean, you know, in some situations, especially for an engineering panel or something like that, this mm-hmm. isn't a view that people use. But yeah, we'll step back and see sort of how we can abstract that out even more to make it simpler and simpler each step out that we go.
All right. Coming up, Dan, we're going to see about calendar-based stuff and logic flows. And logic flows is something that I think I understand, but I'm not sure. So I'm eager to hear about your explanation of what a logic flow is. Hey, it's This Week in Radio Tech, number 539. I'm Kirk Harnack. Dan Bays is my guest. He's the project manager for Pathfinder, and he's got a lot of experience both in commercial recording applications, broadcasting, and also in routing of not only audio, but controls and metadata and a lot of if-then-else programming, basically automating stuff that you just don't have to worry about anymore because it handles itself. And he comes up with great ways to make that happen. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you in part by our friends at Broadcast Bionics. We'll be right back.
Camera One from Broadcast Bionics. Designed to bring video to your audio content. Visualizing radio and podcasts for social media. Camera One can automatically create, capture, and brand professionally switched video for live streaming or upload, making your production shareable. Control and configure using a web browser on any device. Camera One is available as a 4-camera or 8-camera system using the Blackmagic A10 Mini range, including the A10 Mini Extreme. You can use cameras to suit your studio and your budget. You'll need one camera for a studio wide shot, and usually one camera per microphone. A standard multi-channel sound card or IP driver monitors audio from each studio microphone, and we work natively with Axia systems. Ideally, this will be a post-fader feed from each mic, although you can use pre-fade audio or a mic split if that's all you have available. These audio levels are used to intelligently switch the video feed when each contributor is talking. You can also group microphones together into one shot and use the audio from a mixer's aux bus. You can use Camera One's auto switch feature, or disable it and switch using the on-screen buttons or the buttons on the A10. Recordings can automatically start when you tell the system you're on the air. This on-air indication can be linked to your studio's red lights via IP or an Avantech Atom GPIO interface. You can quickly browse all the videos that have been automatically created during your broadcast, download them, and post. Camera One is a user-installable system. You'll need a good-spec Windows 10 PC, i7 with plenty of storage, and 16GB of RAM. It's better if this machine isn't used for anything else. Remember, you can control the software in a web browser on another device on your network. Camera One, a thrifty way of creating scroll-stopping video from your show or podcast from Broadcast Bionics.
And check out Broadcast Bionics at bionic.radio. On the web and in the U.S., talk to our friends at Broadcasters General Store about all the cool stuff from Broadcast Bionics. Good folks. They make nice stuff. It really enhances radio. It's putting us into the future, as you saw. All right. It's Kirk Harnack in the Telos Alliance studio in Nashville, Tennessee, talking to Dan Bays. Dan is a developer, a programmer. He writes millions of lines of code. Dan, you're the primary author of Pathfinder. You and sometimes you have team members that work with you that contribute as well. How many lines of code are in Pathfinder these days?
I honestly have not counted, and I really don't know anymore. It's one of those things I should actually run a query to figure that out someday, just for my own edification. But at this point in time, I really don't know.
well, let's move into a couple of the next slides, if you don't mind, because we're going to run out of time if we don't move ahead. The next one, it looks like a calendaring function. Is that what that is?
Yeah. So that router that we were just looking at in the next, in the last one, it was still a manual process to make the changes. Yeah, we've got lots of layers that are taking care of things under the hood for us, but it was still a manual change. So what we've got here now is taking another step back. We've got resources across the top. I should have come up with a better name than AAA for one of my resources, but you've got one that's called an air chain and one that's called AAA, and then you've got some templates along the left. And so you drag the template onto the resource, and it's actually going to schedule that route change, or maybe it's a scene change, or whatever you want to have happen, whatever you set those resources and templates up to do. And then they'll happen at that point in time, and you don't have to worry about it anymore. It just happens. So this is actually a new feature within Pathfinder Corporate. I mean, we've had time-based events for a long time, but the actual calendar scheduling is fairly new. So,
gotcha. All right. Time-based, you know, years ago, a friend of mine worked at WDIA, WHRK in Memphis. And back then, it must have been in the 70s, one station was country and the other was urban. And so it was an interesting mix. This was just after a lot of racial strife. So it was an interesting mix of people coming to the lobby to get their prizes, right? And they had to go up the elevator together. And this is in Memphis, Tennessee. So it wasn't always, you know, just milk and honey. So in the elevator, they had to choose which station played on the elevator speaker. And apparently every day it would switch between the country station or the urban station, you know? And so there's always one group of people that looked a little uncomfortable riding the elevator up. You're and the program director at the country station told me about this. And actually, come to think of it, I also knew the program director for the urban station. So I've known both of these guys. So yeah, Pathfinder could make this, you know, switch whenever you wanted, right? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you can also, I mean, the other thing is that, you know, you could also have an automation system that sends commands to Pathfinder to make these switches as well. So that's another way that you can go about doing this. I mean, you can build all these layers, and then the automation system will talk to Pathfinder as if it was, you know, whatever router that the automation system knows about. And
imagine, Pathfinder could do this. Let's imagine, now they were both on the same floor. But imagine if these stations were on different floors, see? And if you went in the elevator and punched the floor for the country station to go to, then you'd hear the country station and the speaker, right? And then if you push for the floor for the urban station, you'd hear the urban station on the speaker. And that'd be interesting.
That would be fun. Yeah, I've got to figure out how to get that elevator signal out.
That's right. I'm sure you can. I'm sure there's a protocol to do that.
Right. Pry the button off, and we'll put a little GPIO closure in there, wired up.
All right. Let's see what's next in our tour here. Suncast. So, what's the next picture? Oh yeah, flows. Yes.
Yeah, and this is the simplest flow you can make. I realized after the fact we should have added another picture in there that shows some more complex flows that have got ands and ors and all kinds of weird, interesting things. But the basic concept between a logic flow is it's kind of like an if-then-else. So in this particular case, what we're saying is on the left-hand side, we've got a start point. So the start point is some property that we're monitoring for changes. In this case, it's a GPIO pin. And then on the right-hand side, we've got a button indicator. And then in the middle, we have a translation. So what we're saying is anytime the pin state is low, then we're going to turn the button indicator on. And anytime the pin state is high, we're going to turn it off. Now, we could add an and after that so that we could do something like you have to hold two pins down to turn the indicator on. Well, I don't know why you'd want to do that with the indicator. Where this becomes a little more interesting is if instead of the indicator on the right-hand side, maybe that's a route change. And so this is something that we get pretty frequently is you don't want somebody bumping a button that changes the air chain. And so we do a double push where you've got to hold two buttons down to make it. Anyway, the point here is that anything that Pathfinder knows about, because remember that Pathfinder is not just monitoring sources and destinations on the network. It's monitoring, you know, the mix engines, it's monitoring the consoles. So it knows when somebody moves a fader, it knows when somebody's pushed a button. And all of those end up as properties in here that we can then that we can make decisions about. Another one that a lot of people use is whenever somebody loads a show profile, it may go out and do a bunch of other changes, you know, route to a particular automation system, and you know, so it's really designed as a tool that you can use to customize your workflow.
These inputs and reactions, I understand, can happen very quickly. But in the early days of Pathfinder, there was some question as to if these were quick enough for the broadcasting business, which sometimes has split-second route changes so that you don't get a ragged route change between the end of a commercial and the rejoin of a network or something like that. And you had this really cool thing that you did. You wanted to show people that, no, this is really fast. The network is actually fast. You're thinking of your business network and the salesperson hitting the print five times before it starts to show up on the printer, and then they get five copies of it because they were idiots. But you actually wrote a whack-a-mole game in Pathfinder to show people that they couldn't beat, to show them how fast it actually was. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, if memory serves, I wrote that at the NAB show floor. And so it was a combination of trying to show how fast it was and being bored on the NAB show floor.
You wrote it on the show floor. Wow.
I believe we did. Yes. If I'm not mistaken. Gosh.
All right. So we looked at the logic flows. What are these properties? Whenever you got a source, you got to understand something about that source, and your machine that's making decisions has to understand something about that source. So let's look at the property selector here.
Yeah, so these next two are actually, and I threw these in here, but we can kind of skip past them. Basically, these are just the user interface for picking that start point and end point in that logic flow that we were just looking at. So we can kind of jump past these, but this is what it gets. You just get a list of a tree, basically, of everything that's on the network, and you can pick a property in there. And it's intelligent enough to know when you pick a specific property. Then when you go to the translation side, you'll notice that on the left-hand side, we've got high and low, and on the right-hand side, we've got on and off. If we were actually to drop that down, there's also pulse and blink. And so it knows we've picked an indicator, and it knows what kinds of values that indicator can have. And so that's how we can make these decisions.
So these last two slides have made my head spin a little bit. It's the kind of thing like, okay, I'll understand this for as long as it takes me to configure it. But what's the result of understanding these things? What can you do with this? And I think the next slide begins to show us an example of what we can see, what we can do, what we can present. So let's see the next slide here, Suncast. He's working on it. There we go.
The logic flows, the logic flow that we looked at earlier, that's what those last two slides were all about. It was just setting that logic flow up. But what this is, if this is designing your own user interfaces. So, just like you were saying earlier, that route change, that 4x4 matrix is probably more than some people, the station engineers want some people to have access to. And so, We added a user interface where you can actually drag and drop widgets or pieces, buttons and meters and all those kinds of things directly onto a palette. And then we can connect those up to what we want to have happen using the property list on the right-hand side and save that as a panel. And then if we start skipping to the next ones, you'll see examples of what these panels end up looking like when they're done. So this is a panel that somebody created for the producer, where each of those seats, if you touch that seat, you can actually talk to that person. And so if you touch the circle in the middle, it'll actually talk to all of the seats. And then in addition, you've got, you've brought in your dump button for your dump status for your delay. Brought in a couple of, so basically you've taken pieces, parts from all over the system and brought them together into a user interface that makes sense for this particular person who's trying to run this show. And that's the kind of things, again, we're taking another layer step back in the whole kind of orchestrating this whole system. And now we've created this user interface that, under the hood, each time we touch one of those buttons, we may be making several route changes under the hood. This is one panel. We'll jump through a couple of other panels just to give you sort of an idea of what you can do with the user panel side of things. Yeah. So this is going to be more of an engineering kind of panel where you're actually seeing it's similar to the crosspoint matrix we saw, but it has places where you can touch to listen and the meters, and this is all related to codecs. And if you really ask me what this does, I'm going to tell you I don't entirely know. This is something that a customer camp cooked up, and yeah.
Well, so it looked like
it makes sense to them, and I'm glad.
They had a definite goal in mind. It's ARN, whoever that is. It may be Australia or Arkansas or I don't know where, Austria. Who knows what ARN is? Or maybe it's the audio radio network.
But in any case, this is this would be more of a panel for to happen in a network operation center or a technical center kind of a thing. So
let's move on to the next picture then.
Yeah. So this one is it's got some faders. And so this might, in the time of COVID, this might be a user interface. You actually might have somebody use to control the console back at the office. In this case, they're changing how the user interface. I think this particular customer, if memory serves, they decided that the user interfaces that are built in that come with the consoles weren't quite what they wanted. So they built their own using this tool to make it customized to what they want.
It's worthwhile to point out that you can build these little panels. And now, can you access this with HTML, or is this an app on your local computer, or both, or either one?
No, these are just you're literally when you're using that design tool, you're building a web page. And so once it's built, then you can access it with any web browser, one on your phone or one on your iPad or whatever, and it just works.
Given proper access then to whatever to the machine that's running Pathfinder, a remote person can bring this up, and I understand it's not a whole lot of data between the two. In other words, an ordinary internet connection will handle this just fine in terms of running levels up and down, controlling, and getting feedback as to what's going on.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. Nice. Yeah. It's mostly just control data. It's not, about the most data you're going to see is the metering data. And that's, it's really not that much.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah. All right, let's see what's next. Oh yeah. Now this is getting familiar. I've seen something like this.
Yeah, this is basically the same kind of thing we were just looking at in the last one, but it's a little bit more. This is literally just they wanted to have pretty much a mimic of one of the consoles. Though they've actually thrown an extra channel in there. That channel zero on there is actually not controlling a mixer. That's actually controlling a node source. So, this is where you can start kind of designing your own user interface for that. And then another set of buttons to do whatever they wanted to do on down the right hand side. So again, it's all about kind of picking and choosing how you want things to look for the end user. Mm-hmm.
This does look a lot like, not completely like, but a lot like the IQS virtual audio console that you access with HTML. But you, like you just said, this is accessed. Well, it's shown right here at the top of the picture. This is a web page. It's amazing. Yeah. What you can do now with HTML5 on a web page and the amount of control and feedback and how fast it works. It's not jerky. It's not janky, I think, in the word of developers. It's pretty smooth.
Well, and a big part of that is the advent of WebSockets. I mean, back in the day, this was more of a RESTful API where basically each change would have to be almost like a page refresh. Whereas now we can open up a data socket underneath that is a stream of data back and forth that we can use for this kind of thing. And that really helps for these kinds of situations. So,
and we have one more picture here before we close out. That's pretty.
This picture is, I think if you actually look at the title of this picture, it's called Kitchen Sink.
Okay. All right.
It's because basically this is like all of the widgets that dropped onto a single panel and displayed. But one of the things that's kind of interesting to talk about with this is when we first started building panels, the first thing we started out with was just a couple of widgets. There may be a button and a meter and a fader and, maybe a label, that kind of thing. And one of the things, those basic building blocks people can do a lot of things with those. So then what we start doing is we start working with customers and seeing what the customers build. And so the customers will come back to us and say, hey, look at this really cool thing I built. But you know what? It took me a long time. We've got all of these pieces, parts, and I had to hook them all up. And we start looking at that and saying, well, guess what? The guy down the street's building the same thing. And so then we start building meta widgets, widgets that are all the buttons and the faders and everything that are all baked together, and then maybe we move it out to being able to drag and drop a full console on there. So this is a constant source of development in Pathfinder. Is, you know, we add more and more capability to do these things, but by the same token, we're also trying to figure out how to make it simpler for people to do the same kinds of things over and over again. And so that's just one of these things that we continually are working on.
I noticed that you never require people to write code or do command line or write scripting. Even though some of the pictures we saw earlier, to me, you know, had a lot of numbers on them. They had a lot of things to pick from, but it's usually, you know, pick this and drag it, or use that as a defining characteristic of a button or a fader. So your interfaces tend to, they're as simple as they can be, but no simpler, right?
Yeah, and that's really what we were trying to do, especially with things like the logic flows, is we were really trying to make that to be graphical, not only graphical to configure, but graphical to watch what's going on. So those logic flows will actually change colors and light as the states change. So it makes it easier to see what's going on in the system and to build those kinds of things. That's not to say there's actually a very powerful API that, you know, if somebody wanted to write their own scripts, they could use to do that. In fact, the web pages that we're looking at are actually using that API under the hood to do everything that they're doing. And so, you know, if you wanted to, you could create routers, destroy routers, you know, completely do whatever you wanted with that API if you wanted to write your own interface. So
we're talking to Dan Bays. Dan is the program, the project manager for the Pathfinder at the Telos Alliance. And Dan's been doing this for quite a long time, dating back into the 1990s. Or even 1980s, routing things around a recording studio. We're running out of time pretty quickly. Dan, when we come back in our very last, very short segment, we usually ask for a tip of the week. By the way, I wanted to mention that if you are a person who has been using Pathfinder PC, there's so much more available in the next versions of Pathfinder. Dan, would you address that for just a minute? I know there are plenty of radio stations that have put in Pathfinder PC. They're used to its way of working with and building things. And I think you've done something that's better, more powerful, and in many ways simpler.
That was really the goal. I mean, we tried to take everything that we learned from writing the first Pathfinder and say, okay, how can we make this more graphical, easier to use, and at the same time, more powerful, because there's things that you can do, like, for example, the property router that are not really present in the old version of Pathfinder. And so, you know, it continues to grow. It continues to evolve. It continues to get both more powerful and hopefully simpler to use at the same time. I mean, that, you know, there are certainly things that you can do that are very complex in it and are going to be very complex in it. But, you know, we continue to try to simplify those kinds of things. So, yeah.
I have found that people who have used Pathfinder, and I don't know, there may be other products out there on the market. I don't know. I mean, there's a product out there called VizTool that I think is pretty powerful. People like to use, and there's other things out there as well. But what I have found is that broadcast engineers who delve into the capabilities of Pathfinder, find it to be a very, maybe I overuse this word, a very serendipitous experience. The more they find out about it, the more they figure out that they can do. And some of our customers, some people who use Pathfinder, just really make it stand up and walk and talk and do some amazing things, especially during these COVID times. There are folks, for example, Rob Bertrand and his crew over at WAMU, they had to come up with some pretty sophisticated ways to handle phone calls and getting guests ready to be on a codec and do it remotely. They weren't at the radio station. They had to have producers and wranglers, if you will, doing this from home. And they built panels with Pathfinder that allowed them to create routes at the radio station that would let the producer talk to a guest on the phone or on a codec. It's pretty amazing what they were able to do. And they did it. You know, without Pathfinder, they could not have done all that. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Yeah. No, this is what is fun about it. What I really enjoy about working on this project is, you know, you turn it loose in the wild and then you see what customers come up with, because mm-hmm. it's like, a lot of times I'll see stuff. It's like, wow, I never would have thought of that. You know, that's really cool.
And that's what makes it so serendipitous. Hey, Dan, when we come back for our last 2 minute segment, I always forget to ask a tip of the week. If you've got a tip for people who maybe haven't delved into this kind of orchestration, automation software, what they should be thinking about, if they should think, hey, that's something that would help me out, or maybe some other tool that is good for broadcasters to be aware of that maybe you know of, it's under your hat and you want to share. We'll be right back. Our show This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you in part by our friends at Angry Audio. And you know what? Suncast, don't go to the website. I want to real quick just talk about these products from the Studio Hub division at Angry Audio. Studio Hub Plus. If you wire a radio station, if you wire a studio and you're not using Studio Hub stuff, you are spending time that you don't have to. Oh my goodness. These are worth their weight. Well, practically in gold. Gold's up pretty high right now, but I wouldn't wire a studio without this. You know what? I tried. Actually, the last studio I wired was a production room at one of my radio stations, and I had the thing 95% wired, and I forgot I didn't have the right connectors to go into the back of a CD player. It needed RCA connectors. So I had to build up a cable with an RJ45 at one end and RCA connectors at the other. And then I know it was an unbalanced to balance situation. It worked out fine. But I had to fire up a soldering iron. You talk about first world problems. Well, these are your first world solutions right here. A Studio Hub Plus from Angry Audio. Now, there are some knockoffs out there on the market, and I got to tell you, why get a knockoff when really for the same price, you can get the original Studio Hub. Now, Studio Hub, they have worked for years to develop the injection molding and the connectorization techniques inside to get stranded, shielded audio cable to go into an RJ45 jack. And that is quite some engineering to get that to happen. You even think it's easy, you try it. It's not. And they came up with some great ways to put stranded audio cable, flexible audio cable, into an RJ45 jack. And then, of course, at the other end, well, it's standard procedure to run that into some XLR connectors, or maybe you want to run them into some quarter-inch tip-ring sleeve connectors. But if you're wiring any kind of audio over IP, even if you're wiring a traditional analog or AES EBU studio, there are plenty of solutions from Studio Hub to make that happen. Now, if you want to check out this stuff and look at some papers, if you've never done Studio Hub before, you owe it to yourself to read a little bit about it and see how you can save yourself hours of trouble and burnt fingers from soldering if you're not very good at it like I'm not. Check it out. Go to angryaudio.com, angryaudio.com, and check out Studio Hub. Yes, they're back. They're made in the same factory they always have been, the same jigs, the same people, the same experts making Studio Hub adapters. And they have, you know, almost the whole line here. It's just a terrific selection of Studio Hub stuff. And of course, on the Angry Audio site, you'll find some of the other things that Angry Audio designs and produces. Headphone amps, the Bluetooth audio gadget, all kinds of things to help you with your studio, whether it's a studio in a professional environment or even a home studio. They got lots of stuff to do it. Check it out, angryaudio.com. And hey, our show is brought to you also in part by Max Connect Wireless. And I think we got a quick testimonial here from my friend Gary Morrill. Gary?
I'm Gary Morrill, Midwest Regional Director of Engineering for Alpha Media. When I first spoke with Josh Bone about Max Connect, he told me they'd work great for remote transmitter sites where connectivity was a challenge. And you know, he's absolutely right. We even have sites where we're using this as a backup to our STL using Max Connect's dual carrier option, and it works perfectly. We also have times where we need to be able to get out to a venue where it's kind of challenging because everybody and his brother is trying to stream video at the same time, like at a big sporting event. And you know what? Our data gets through every time because it's prioritized packet data. It works for us. It'll work for you. Max Connect. Check it out.
MaxConnectWireless.com is the website, and good stuff. If you need connectivity at a transmitter site on a remote broadcast, and it's prioritized too, you get your data through, even if you're at a busy stadium. You know, we're going to get back to that at some point. And when you get back to going to a stadium with 10,000, 20,000, 60,000 fans in the stands, you're going to want your 4G LTE to work, and MaxConnect Wireless will work. Thanks a lot to MaxConnect Wireless for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech at maxconnectwireless.com. All right, real quick, Dan Bays is our guest. Dan, have you got a tip of the week that you can send our folks away with?
So my tip of the week would be test your redundancy.
Oh.
So this is another area of passion and interest of mine is just redundancy in general, clustering, being able to, make sure that in a failure state, things take over. And too often I see customers or people will set up something that's supposed to be redundant, but they don't actually thoroughly test it. And then it fails and they scream. It's the same concept in IT. They talk about a backup is not a backup unless you've actually tried restoring it. And so it's the same kind of concept where you actually have to find some time to go through the possible breakages you're trying to solve for and actually make sure that you're that works, whatever may be.
That is so right. That just burned me actually this weekend. I had a backup. I had an automation computer fail, and I had a backup and I thought it was up to date, but no, it was from October 2020.
Yeah.
Thanks for that tip. I really need to heed these tips. I really, really do. Hey, we got to go. Dan Bays, project manager at Pathfinder. Dan, thank you for your expertise. Thank you for lending so much, usability and automation to broadcast facilities with stuff that actually works and works well. Appreciate it.
I appreciate being on, and I appreciate doing this work. It's a lot of fun.
It is. It is. It's good to use your stuff. All right. Hey, thanks a lot to the GFQ network, including Suncast, who has done another stellar job of switching this program and manning the controls. I appreciate that very much. Also, thanks to Andrew Zarian, the founder of the GFQ network, where you'll find lots of other cool, cool things. Hey, we got a great guest next week. I don't have it in front of me, but I know I really do know it's good. I think David Layer from NAB is going to be our guest pretty soon. He's got some great thoughts on the direction of radios in automobiles. Some good news, bad news, what we can do about it. That's coming up next on next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.